content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the November 2023 edition of Education Today. We'll get started with an article from Education Week titled, How to Talk About the Israel-Hamas War, Resources for Educators, by Lorraine Langriot, posted October 9, 2023. Updated. This story has been updated to reflect recent developments in Israel and Gaza. Soon after the surprise Hamas attack on Israel earlier this month, the San Diego County Office of Education released a memo with a list of resources that educators and parents can use to help young children and adolescents think and talk about this international crisis. The Associated Press reported that the violence had caused at least 2,800 deaths on both sides as of October 13th and unleashed some of the greatest violence the region has seen in years. California is home to students and staff with cultural ties to Israel and Palestine, and has seen a rise in anti-Semitic and Islamophobic incidents even before the outbreak of war, according to the October 7 memo. As educators, we must make sure we provide a safe space for all members of our community to learn about current events and process their emotions. Other school district leaders are taking similar steps to help their communities process the Hamas attack and the ensuing Israeli response. It is heartbreaking to see the devastating impact of terrorism on innocent civilians, especially our most vulnerable, children, tweeted New York City Schools Chancellor David C. Banks. He added that his district will be, quote, providing resources to our schools to facilitate discussions about the conflict and supporting our students in being compassionate global citizens. Fred Rundle, the superintendent of Mercer Island School District in Washington State, sent out an October 9 memo providing resources for educators and parents to use to discuss the crisis with their students and children. Our hearts are with our students, staff, and families impacted by the horrific events in Israel and Gaza, Rundle wrote. This is a scary and emotional time, especially for our Mercer Island community, who is so connected to this part of the world. On October 7, Hamas, a Palestinian militant group that has governed more than 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip since 2006, launched its largest surprise attack ever on Israel, prompting Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to declare war. While Hamas has governed the territory since 2006, dozens of countries label it as a terrorist organization, and it receives substantial support from Iran, according to the Council of Foreign Relations, a nonpartisan think tank. Israel responded with airstrikes on cities in the Palestinian territory, and Hamas has continued to fire rockets into Israel. Israel has blocked deliveries of food, water, and fuel, and shut down electricity to the Gaza Strip. On October 13, Israel's military ordered more than 1 million civilians living in northern Gaza to evacuate, a possible precursor to a ground invasion. Israel has been massing troops along the Gaza border since the Hamas attack, and on October 13, they entered the border to battle militants, according to reporting from the Associated Press. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is rooted in a millennia-old territorial dispute over the Holy Land, a region in the Middle East with religious and historical significance to Jews, Muslims, and Christians. Israel and Hamas have exchanged attacks for decades. For instance, in May 2021, an Israeli police raid on the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem set off an 11-day war between the two. This weekend's attack took place on the 50th anniversary of the Yom Kippur War, when a coalition of Arab states attacked Israel and just before the Jewish holiday of Simchat Torah. To help educators explain the conflict and guide students in how to talk about emotionally charged, violent events like this in measured, respectful ways, Education Week has collected several resources. Those resources are intended to help students understand historical context, process current events, and use media literacy skills to analyze news coverage and social media responses and misinformation about the conflict. Making a difference in the midst of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, wide-angle lesson plan. This high school-level lesson plan from PBS explores the history and complexity of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict through videos, websites, and interactive activities that provide more insight into the conflict. Fears of bigger war grow as Israel-Hamas fighting continues. PBS has also created daily news lessons to guide discussions with students about the Israel-Hamas war using PBS NewsHour's reporting. What is U.S. policy on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? This guide from the Council on Foreign Relations provides background information behind the conflict and explains what the United States has done to negotiate a resolution to the conflict. Conflict in Israel and Palestine Crash Course. An educational YouTube channel explains the origins of the long-standing conflict in under 13 minutes. And we'll have to cut this article short for time. The next article comes from the New York Times, and it's titled, Louisiana Public School Principal Who Punished Student for Dancing Apologizes. Jason St. Pierre cited religion to discipline a 17-year-old for what he deemed inappropriate dancing at an off-campus homecoming after-party. By Claire Moses, posted October 12. The principal of a public high school in Louisiana, who cited religion as justification for punishing a student after a video of her dancing circulated on social media, has apologized and asked for a leave for the rest of the school year. The principal of Walker High School, Jason St. Pierre, prompted an outcry after he stripped Kaylee Timonet, 17, of her position as president of the school's Student Government Association, and rescinded a scholarship endorsement. The punishment was in response to a video of her dancing behind another student at an off-campus party after homecoming. Ms. Timonet said in a video interview on the website Unfiltered with Kieran that she was dancing behind a friend, quote, hyping her up. She said that the principal, Mr. St. Pierre, and the assistant principal called her into their office on Tuesday and told her that she was stripped of her student government post. She said she started crying hysterically. In the same video interview, Ms. Timonet said the school administrators told her that she should be ashamed of herself as well as concerned for her afterlife because she, quote, wasn't following God's ideals, which made me cry even more. Public outrage followed, and online critics made comparisons to Footloose, a fictional movie about a conservative small town where dancing is illegal. Others posted under the hashtag, #LetTheGirlDance. In his apology, Mr. St. Pierre said this week that members of the student government were held to a high standard of behavior. While I stand by that premise, I do believe that standard deserves the input of not just myself and top administrators, but also those student leaders, Mr. St. Pierre added in a statement. I hope to create a path moving forward where we can work together to create clear expectations for all. Local news media has reported that since the apology was posted on the school's website and app, Mr. St. Pierre requested a leave for the rest of the school year. Bruce Chaffin, the assistant superintendent of schools for the school district, refused to comment on Thursday. Multiple members of the Livingston Parish School District, of which Walker High School is part, didn't immediately return requests for comment. Mr. St. Pierre said he would reinstate Ms. Timonet as the student government president and restore his endorsement needed for a Student Government Association scholarship application for Ms. Timonet. Ms. Timonet and her mother said in their taped videos that the deadline to apply for the scholarship had passed. Ms. Timonet's mother, Rachel, said in a self-taped video that she was at the party where the dancing occurred and that, quote, there was nothing inappropriate at all to me. There are two things I have always taught my kids not to talk about. One is politics and one is religion, she said in a self-taped video also posted on Unfiltered with Kieran. Ms. Timonet and her mother were not immediately available for comment. In his apology, Mr. St. Pierre said he had, quote, the best intentions in invoking religion. I do understand it is not my responsibility to determine what students' or others' religious beliefs may be, he said. Jill Heinrich, a professor of education at Cornell College in Iowa, said that teachers and principals at public schools function as an arm of the state. With that in mind, religion mostly has no place in a public school, she said, unless it's being studied in a secular way. You can talk about religious events in history class, Ms. Heinrich said, adding that, quote, there can be absolutely no advocacy. The next article comes from the Washington Post, and it's titled, U.S. Institutions Under Fire for Their Support or Silence on Israel, by Laura Meckler, Tim Craig, and Aaron Gregg. It might seem like a safe move. Condemn violence on both sides of the conflict in Israel and express support for Jews and Palestinians alike because of the losses they've suffered. but in a moment this heavy with emotion and rage, few moves are safe. U.S. companies, politicians, universities, and school districts who took that approach found themselves under fire from Jewish groups and others for appearing to downplay what began this crisis a week ago, a militant attack by Hamas on Israel that killed hundreds of civilians. Jewish parents in the suburbs of Boston, Washington, and elsewhere protested after their school leaders put out statements that sought a measure of neutrality. Senator Edward J. Markey, Democrat from Massachusetts, appearing at a vigil in Boston, was booed when he called for de-escalation of the current violence. And at Stanford University, faculty protested after university leaders wrote to students about the devastating crisis in Israel and Palestine, without calling out Hamas as the aggressor. After a series of anti-Israel and anti-Semitic messages and incidents spread across campus, Stanford's president and provost sent a lengthy letter describing some of them and referring to horrifying new details about the Hamas attack in Israel last weekend, which involved intolerable atrocities, including murder of civilians and kidnapping. This was the dynamic in the initial days of fighting, as bodies of Israelis of all ages were found and stories of hostage-taking spread fear and anger. What's unknown is how the mood might shift as Israel forces continue laying siege to Gaza, cutting off all water and electricity, and then launch a full-scale counteroffensive, which could mean enormous civilian casualties among Palestinians who have nowhere to flee. Figuring out what to say has gripped college campuses in particular. Conflict in the Middle East has for decades fueled student and faculty activism and divided academic communities. At Harvard University, for instance, the student organizations that make up the Harvard College Palestine Solidarity Committee issued a statement in the immediate aftermath of the Hamas attack saying the Israeli regime is entirely responsible for all the unfolding violence. That prompted a rebuke from former Harvard President Larry H. Summers, who said on X, formerly Twitter, that he was, quote, sickened by the university's silence. Administrators then issued a statement expressing hope that Harvard could modulate rather than amplify the deep-seated divisions. Several leaders of the Harvard Divinity School urged a reframing of the events to look not just at the Hamas attack, but at decades of oppression on the part of Israel. Those sentiments, in turn, prompted a critical open letter response from dozens of faculty members. After that came yet another statement, this time from Harvard President Claudine Gay, condemning Hamas's actions as terrorist atrocities. Corporate leaders, too, have struggled to walk an appropriate line between acknowledging a traumatic moment and weighing the very real business risks of saying the wrong thing. Their dilemma is familiar. In 2020, after the killing of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer sparked nationwide protests, some chief executives issued statements that failed to capture the moment, while others faced employee anger for saying nothing. Since then, companies such as Disney, Target, and Anheuser-Busch have been swept up in the nation's cultural and political battles. This week, many proceeded gingerly. The chip maker Intel, which counts more than 11,700 employees at 5 facilities in Israel, told Reuters it was closely monitoring the situation and taking steps to safeguard and support our workers. Microsoft condemned the hatred and brutality and pointed to acts of terrorism without naming Hamas. A statement from Chief Human Resources Officer Kathleen Hogan expressed sympathy for Israelis who have been killed, injured, or lost loved ones, and said the company's main focus was the safety of its nearly 3,000 workers there. It also addressed Microsoft's Jewish and Palestinian employees globally, noting the fears and concerns that each group is feeling. At Starbucks, the dispute was between the corporation and some employees. In now-deleted social media posts, a faction calling itself Starbucks Workers United expressed solidarity with Palestine. After a backlash from conservative media outlets, Starbucks issued its own statement that the company unequivocally condemns acts of terrorism, hate, and violence. It added, "Workers United's words and actions belong to them and them alone." Other business leaders were more overtly pro-Israel, including Bill Ackman, an outspoken hedge fund manager whose philanthropic work has included Jewish causes. He lashed out against the Harvard students behind the anti-Israel statement and said several chief executives wanted to know the identities of those involved so as to ensure that none of us inadvertently hire any of their members. Political groups also risked alienating even strong supporters. In the immediate aftermath of the Hamas attack, the Democratic Socialists of America expressed, quote, solidarity with Palestine and wrote on Instagram, today's events are the direct result of Israel's apartheid regime. That infuriated comedian Sarah Silverman, who said she had been a lifetime member. She unleashed a profanity-filled tirade that excoriated the organization for failing to understand the violence perpetrated on Israelis by Hamas. Some school districts learned the same lesson about how hard or perhaps impossible it is to get their message right. In Montgomery County, Maryland, which has the state's largest school system, Superintendent Monifa B. McKnight wrote families midweek to warn parents about upsetting videos and images from the attacks that were circulating on social media. She noted that many in the community were experiencing fear, anxiety, and grief. Jewish groups responded that this was both overdue and inadequate, saying several area school districts had fallen short but directing particular anger at Montgomery. Our school system's refusal to honestly name the largest slaughter of Jews since the Holocaust is infuriating and disheartening to our entire community, the D.C. branches of the Jewish Community Relations Council and the Anti-Defamation League declared. The pushback came in the opposite direction in Northern Virginia after school board meetings in Arlington County, where the superintendent opened the session by expressing support for the Jewish community, and Fairfax County, where the board took a moment of silence to honor the victims, their loved ones, and the entire Jewish community who are suffering from Saturday's vicious terrorist attack by Hamas and Israel. In Arlington, Shema Al-Hanoudi asked during a public comment period why the district was not recognizing Palestinians. I heard your remarks about the safety of our Jewish students. Can we expect to hear similar comments extended to your Muslim and Palestinian families and staff? And in Fairfax, school board member Abrar Omish asked why, quote, we buy into a rhetoric that negates not only the humaneness of Palestinians, but justifies the indiscriminate retaliation against the population. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The next article comes from USA Today, and it's titled, California High School Grad Lands Job at Google After Being Rejected by 16 Colleges, by Emily DeLetter, posted October 13. Google has hired a California high school graduate after he was rejected by 16 colleges, including both Ivy League and state schools. 18-year-old Stanley Zong graduated from Gunn High School in Palo Alto, California, a city part of Silicon Valley. According to ABC 7 Eyewitness News, he had a 3.97 unweighted and 4.42 weighted GPA, scored 1590 out of 1600 on the SATs, and launched his own e-signing startup his sophomore year called RabbitSign. Zong was applying to colleges as a computer science major. He told ABC 7 some of the applications, especially to the highly selective schools like MIT and Stanford, were certainly expected, but thought he had a good chance at some of the other state schools. He had planned to enroll at the University of Texas, but has instead decided to put school on hold when he was offered a full-time software engineering job at Google. Impact of affirmative action ruling on higher education. Zong was rejected by 16 out of the 18 colleges to which he applied: MIT, Carnegie Mellon, Stanford, UC Berkeley, UCLA, UCSD, UCSB, UC Davis, Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, Cornell University, University of Illinois, University of Michigan, Georgia Tech, Caltech, University of Washington, and University of Wisconsin. He was accepted only by the University of Texas and University of Maryland. A witness testifying to a September 28 hearing to the House Committee on Education and the Workforce brought up Zong's story in a session about affirmative action, which was outlawed in June by the Supreme Court and most colleges and universities. Affirmative action was a decades-old effort to diversify campuses. The June Supreme Court ruling requires Harvard and the University of North Carolina, along with other schools, to rework their admissions policies and may have implications for places outside higher education, including the American workforce. The next article comes from NPR, and it's titled, A Black Texas Student Suspended for His Hairstyle is Shifted to an Alternative School, October 12, 2023, by Jonathan Franklin. A black high school student in Texas who was suspended for more than a month for wearing a natural hairstyle was removed from his school on Wednesday and transferred to an alternative school. Daryl George, a junior at Barbers Hill High School in Mont Belvieu, a town roughly 30 miles outside of Houston, will be placed in a disciplinary alternative education program through November 29, according to a notice sent from the school district and shared by the student's family. The notice, dated Wednesday, addressed to Daryl's mother, Darisha George, and signed by Barbers Hill High School Principal Lance Murphy, cites violations of multiple infractions of campus and classroom rules, including disruption of the in-school suspension classroom, failure to comply with directives from staff and administration, violation of tardy policy, and violation of the dress and grooming policy. All of the alleged infractions, excluding the tardiness, are apparently connected to his natural hairstyle. Daryl will be allowed to return to class on November 30th, the notice states. As the school principal, I have determined that your child has engaged in chronic or repeated disciplinary infractions that violate the district's previously communicated standards of student conduct, Murphy said in the notice obtained by NPR. Daryl, who turned 18 last week, wears his natural hair in locks, which he says are an expression of cultural pride, according to a federal lawsuit filed last month by the family against Texas Governor Greg Abbott, the state's attorney general, and the school district. Allie Booker, an attorney representing the George family, told NPR that the recent move by the school district is simply, quote, retaliation. Candace Matthews, a civil rights activist and spokeswoman for the George family, said Daryl feels scared as he stands in front of the building for the alternative school. She also said that Daryl still does not plan to cut his hair. "Why do they hate us so much? Our skin is our skin," Matthews told NPR. In a statement to NPR, Barbers Hill Independent School District spokesperson David Bloom said the district is unable to provide any comment with respect to disciplinary matters involving a student, adding that the district, quote, has always allowed protective hairstyles as defined in the Crown Act. Last month, Daryl and Darisha George filed a federal lawsuit in Texas Southern District Court arguing that the student's suspension violates the state's Crown Act, creating a respectful and open world for natural hair, banning race-based hair discrimination. The filing comes after the school asked a court to clarify whether the new law prohibits grooming policies addressing the length of a male student's hair. The student was suspended from the school just before the Texas law went into effect statewide on September 1st. Daryl's suspension continues to generate questions about the legality of punishing students for their hair and the extent of the newly passed law's protections. So far, 24 states, along with the U.S. Virgin Islands, have signed the Crown Act into law. Texas was the 24th state to implement a version of the law. The legislation has been proposed in 20 additional states and Washington, D.C. The next article comes from K-12 Dive, and it's titled, High 2021-22 Chronic Absenteeism Levels Persisted Last School Year, published October 12th, written by Naz Modan. Dive Brief. Chronic absenteeism skyrocketed post-pandemic, with 6.5 million more students missing at least 10% or more of school days in the 2021-22 year than 2017-2018, meaning 14.7 million students were chronically absent even after schools began to reopen post-pandemic closures. Before the pandemic, a quarter of all enrolled students attended schools experiencing high or extreme absenteeism. Yet the analysis found that percentage more than doubled to 66% of students attending schools with high or extreme chronic absenteeism in 2021-2022. In a glimmer of hope, preliminary data from 11 states shows that while chronic absenteeism rates remained relatively elevated in 2022-2023, they decreased slightly by 2% from the high levels of 2021-2022, according to a separate analysis published by Attendance Works. Dive Insight. Attendance Works, an organization that advocates for improved attendance policies and practices, analyzed new U.S. Department of Education data to determine national absenteeism levels in 2021-2022. The organization's additional data aggregation from 11 states for the 2022-2023 school year suggests schools continue to grapple with high chronic absenteeism reflected in the national data. Hetty Chang, executive director of the organization, told K-12 Dive it could take at least 3 to 4 years to return to pre-pandemic levels of attendance. "It's really about supporting kids over time," she said. The severity of chronic absenteeism and time needed for its recovery can also vary by school cohort. Students who are transitioning between early, elementary, and secondary education at the time of school closures could be more acutely impacted by absenteeism and take longer to bounce back, said Chang. Attendance and education research experts have long suspected the pandemic impacted chronic absenteeism levels as well as academics, and these hunches have been backed up by preliminary polling and anecdotal evidence. For example, in nationally representative school survey data from the U.S. Department of Education released last year, nearly half of schools reported student chronic absenteeism had, quote, increased a lot from before the pandemic. And earlier this year, Attendance Works estimated chronic absenteeism will have increased twofold since the pandemic began, to roughly 16 million students. While the new data falls shy of that number, it confirms theories that COVID-19 exacerbated attendance problems. The organization called the increase, quote, an unprecedented wave of chronic absenteeism in a blog post accompanying its data analysis release on Thursday. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The final article comes from the UK with BBC News. Black History Month. My jaw dropped when I saw what we were learning. By Helen Richardson and Chris Robinson. "We looked at how to escape the plantation," she said. "I was scandalized, because what sort of lesson plan is that? Even as a 12-year-old and not really having formulated full opinions on these things, my jaw dropped when I saw it, and we had to present these ideas to the class." Now aged 15, the student from Newcastle explained why she believed black history needed to be ingrained across the curriculum. "Stuff like this doesn't help with racism. It encourages ignorance, and ignorance is the worst thing you can have. October is Black History Month in the UK, which offers the opportunity to share, celebrate, and understand the impact of black heritage and culture. Education is a devolved issue, and the government said there was flexibility and freedom within the curriculum to study black history. But Deborah, who is studying for her history GCSE, has called on Westminster to try to diversify the curriculum a bit more. She said when it came to history, she was shocked to find out that there were previously black people in the UK because we never ever talk about it. It's quite unfortunate, really, because the type of figures I look up to are the people inside the media, people like Beyonce when I was growing up. There's a mandatory curriculum that the government can impose. While it's not going to cure everything immediately, I think the first step to solving a problem is acknowledging there is a problem." And we'll have to cut that article short for time. We've run out of time for this episode of Education Today. Please be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Education Today is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.